We'll move right into ground fish. So we'll take a quick 5-minute break, let staff get set up. We'll be back.
The SSC rounded off their figures, so we'll change it, the ABC, to reflect what the SSC actually put forward. I also want to point out that the yellowtail flounder ACLs are going to be recalculated for the scallop fishery in Framework 22, and that because they're going to get, they have a 90% allocation for 90% of the projected need for the scallop fishery. So these numbers will change slightly after we find out what they're implementing in Framework 22. The next measure is the U.S.-Canada Resource Sharing Understanding Tax. We just heard from Loretta what the recommendations for that are, and the Council just approved those, so those will be in the framework. In the next section, we have implementation of new sectors for fishing year 2011. The committee talked about the new sectors. Some of the sectors that submitted proposals to be included in Framework 45 haven't submitted operations plans with the agency. There's some discussion about whether those should still be approved as placeholders for those sectors or whether without an operations plan it makes sense to include them in Framework 45. The next section is a general category scallop dredge exemption for yellowtail flounder. I believe this came up at the last council meeting. It's to make an exemption for general category scallop permits from the Great South Channel yellowtail flounder closure. The coordinates are listed in the document. And then the next section is on monitoring requirements for hand gear A and B vessels and small vessel exemption permit vessels. The option there is to exempt them from dockside monitoring requirements. That was one that came out of the last committee meeting. After that, we have a committee recommendation for an option that there's no dockside monitoring for any commercial ground fish vessels. And in the same section, we have another option for a removal of the requirement for industry funding of monitoring for fishing year 2012. The Ground Fish Committee did recommend that the industry isn't responsible for paying for at-sea monitoring beyond the levels of monitoring provided by the agency in fishing year 2012. And finally, or no, I guess it's not the last measure, we have a measure for a Gulf of Maine cod spawning protection area. This is a suggested closure of the whaleback area, a portion of the whaleback area in the Gulf of Maine. The committee did forward one option for a closure, which was version one from the PDT report. It's a design of a closure that was submitted by fishermen. It's included in the draft measures. And that was the only version of the closure that was forwarded by the committee in addition to the no action alternative. The next measure is for state-operated permit banks. The committee passed a motion to include an authorization for state-operated permit banks in the framework. It was unclear at the committee level whether this was going to be all that was necessary to get the state-operated permit banks operating in fishing year 2011, and the committee was waiting for further guidance from NOAA General Counsel. The next measure is for hand gear A trip limits. This would revise the trip limit, or the option would revise the trip limits for vessels using hand gear A permits to 300 pounds a trip for cod. And they would not be tied to the common pool trip limit, so it would stay at 300 pounds per trip until the portion of the PSC that's held by hand gear vessels was reached in the fishery, in which case the trip limit would go down to zero. This is also something that at the committee meeting wasn't clear whether this could be included in a framework document, so we were waiting for further guidance on this topic as well. And finally, there's alternatives. Under alternatives considered and rejected, there's the the other closures that were identified by the PDT for the Whaleback area that the committee decided not to forward into the document.
Okay. If there's no questions, we'll put the motions up, Karen. I'll read them. To include two options for the Whaleback spawning closure in Framework 45, option number one is the no action, and option number two, which there should be a chart. To include the small vessel fishing permit category C to the dockside monitoring exemption and option two, if fishing in the common pool. To recommend to the council to have a trip limit of 300 pounds for hand gear A permits for Gulf of Maine cod up to the percent sector contribution of hand gear A permits. To recommend to the council that Framework 45 include an option to remove the Amendment 16 requirements for groundfish vessels to pay for at-sea monitoring cost in 2012. And to recommend the council eliminate Amendment 16 requirements for dockside monitoring for the groundfish vessels. It's a committee motion because they're all committee motions. This just weren't combined, so I don't know if it needs a second or not. Discussion. I think one of the I'll wait till somebody else for now, I guess.
Well, I'll just put a second on it because it wasn't. It's a combination motion, seconded by Rip Cunningham. Discussion, Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it also should add, since this is initiating Framework 45, should say to initiate Framework 45 and include. I think that's cleaner.
I thought we initiated it in June. So.
That's fine. Anything else? Frank?
Get most of these passed unanimous at the committee. The only one that didn't, we had quite a bit of discussion, which I think will come up on the Whaleback spawning area closures. And I think Doug may have some comments on that. The other one, the hand gear trip limit, we had some concerns. This is tied to the Gulf of Maine trip limit. We've had some comments and concerns from people fishing on the Georges Bank stock, wondering on why it's tied to the Gulf of Maine trip limit. And I don't know if somebody can clarify that for us or on why the Georges Bank, why the hand gear boats with hand gear permits fishing on the Georges Bank stock are tied to the Gulf of Maine trip limit for cod. When the trip limit goes to zero or when it goes down the Gulf of Maine, you're precluding anybody from fishing on the Georges Bank stock is what's happening once they've reached their allocation in the Gulf of Maine. Because it's...
We'll probably hear something about that out of the audience. Any questions or clarification from the council members? Sally?
Yeah, on the two parts of this motion related to monitoring, just to reiterate and make sure that my recollection of the discussion about the at-sea monitoring requirements for industry to pay for it in 2012, as Ann mentioned, and it's in the rationale, the proposal would delay that requirement by 1 year. It wouldn't put it off entirely. It puts it off for one more year. There was an expression of from the industry of a need for a little more time to get through the transition to sectors, and this was an option that was put forward. There was, my recollection as well, is that there was discussion about the potential for another option being needed because we can't assume that the money is going to be flowing as much as it has been recently, as far out as 2012. So in my view, it would make sense to have an additional option, which is kind of alluded to in the rationale on page 14 of the draft framework document, that would have some kind of cost-sharing arrangement in case the funds aren't available entirely from the agency.
Okay. Doug?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two items. First, I wanted the council to be aware that the state of New Hampshire just put in an application to the a request to the council and to NIMS for a New Hampshire permit bank sector. And I was wondering at this point whether it would be a possibility of having that listed in framework 45 as another potential permit bank, and if I needed a motion to do that.
It was for a permit bank sector or for a permit bank? State permit bank or a sector?
This is a state permit bank sector, similar to what Maine is. But I need a motion to do that, or is that?
Yeah.
Okay. I'd like to move to add into section 1.2 under option 2, the state of New Hampshire's permit bank sector, which application just came in this week.
There's a second. Seconded by Mark Gibson. Discussion?
We have a motion on the floor already that we haven't dealt with.
He's amending.
Is it still amended?
Yes, move to amend.
If I might suggest that we did it on a separate motion, because the next motion is going to deal with permit banks, and I think we'll have a whole discussion on permit banks then, but I don't know.
Yeah, I didn't realize that was your next motion.
So
I think six and one half dozen the other to me, but
it doesn't matter to me. I thought this was included in here because okay. The motion on
that's fine.
I thought that you were coming up with next was on the discussion on permit banks as opposed to sectors.
Pat says this is fine to go in here, so I'm comfortable with it.
We'll keep it in. Seconded by Mark Gibson. Discussion on the motion to amend. Terry Stockwell.
Yeah, I absolutely support this, and I actually I don't know if you might consider it a friendly dog to add in Massachusetts, because they're also about to submit their MOA, and in that way all four states would be eligible to be in operation in 2011.
I certainly would be amenable to that, to add Massachusetts permit bank sector to that. I wish the gentleman from Massachusetts was here. But I knew he was talking about that they were going to submit this week.
We don't get the stuff in time.
Yeah. Tumneys?
This won't be a surprise to the state guys, but just to make sure this is clear, we had some discussion about this yesterday and offline. And what the regulations right now say, I think, is if you're a sector, you have to submit an application at least 1 year before you plan to operate. And so, you know, it's entirely possible that if this gets voted in and these get put in Framework 45, it's possible that approval for these state permit banks to operate, their actual getting off the ground, may not happen till a year from October 1st. I don't think they saw that as a real problem. It may get done earlier, but just so they know up front that that's kind of what the timeline normally looks like.
So I had a question maybe for Annie. So we're calling these state state permit banking sectors. And then section 1.7 on page 17 talks about state-operated permit banks. Are we talking about two different entities, or are we talking about the first thing recognizes it, and then the second, section 1.7 says they're recognized, but they don't actually have to go through the process of forming a sector and all the paperwork, and they don't actually have to have a sector because they're state-run?
Right. I think the idea was to sort of cover all of the bases here because there's still a lot of uncertainty over how the permit banks are going to operate within the sector system and whether the permit banks can be implemented in a framework and what part of the permit bank operations can be implemented in a framework. And because it looks as though, at least for now, they have to operate within the sector system, within the framework, I think the idea was to get them going as sectors, but to maybe lay the groundwork so that in a future action, or if administrative rules change or something changes, that they may be able to operate separately from the sector system as well.
I think Tom wants to fill in a little bit as well.
So, I mean, I think maybe we're taking things a little bit out of order here, but the states are trying to figure out a way to use this money in order that they're getting from the service in order to lease ACE to people in sectors. And so there's been some issues that have been raised. You know, the initial thought was, okay, they can form a sector and operate as a sector. Well, if they form a sector, there's some issues that the states are concerned about. They don't want to have to comply with all of the bureaucratic stuff that a private sector has to comply with. And there are also some technical issues. Can the state, who is a one owner, be a sector when our requirement says that a sector has to have three owners? So that's an issue that's unresolved. So then the idea was, well, let's not make them sectors. Let's put, and this came up at the committee, let's say that a state-operated permit bank will be treated as if it's a sector without calling it a sector. And that's the language that's in a later section. We've had some discussions with NOAA General Counsel, and some of these ideas may not pass muster in a framework. So I think the fallback in here is that let's try and get them the ability to operate as a sector if these other things don't work. And we're not sure this one will work because of the three-owner requirement.
All right. I'm just trying to – I guess what I was trying to figure out is are they – for instance, is Maine forming two things? It's forming an actual permit bank, but it's also forming a permit bank sector?
Well, I mean, I think not, okay? Maybe I should let Terry speak for himself, but we tend to get things clouded when we start using the term permit bank, because in the groundfish plan right now, there's nothing that defines what a permit bank is. And I know this term is used in the industry, and I know it's being used in the NOAA MOAs, I believe, but there's nothing right now in the groundfish plan that does it. What we do have in the groundfish plan is sectors, and we do have some sectors that have said they are operating as a lease-only sector. And so, you know, if you want to be consistent with the current language in the groundfish plan, you would say that what Maine is doing, and this is, I think, how their application was originally written, is they're forming a lease-only sector where nobody's going to fish in the sector. They're just going to lease the ACE to other people. That maybe can happen now if I'm ignoring the three-owner requirement. But then there's been an interest in trying to further that by defining something called a NOAA-sponsored state-operated permit bank, and there's some draft language floating around that we'll probably get to later today that defines that. But we don't really know right now whether we can define and create NOAA-sponsored state-operated permit banks and define them in a framework action or not, or if that takes an amendment. I don't know what point you want to have Gene weigh in on those questions, but now might be as good a time as any.
I guess before we get into what's legal and not legal, I was more interested in what's being proposed.
I mean, I
see a lot of state director hands up, so I'll go to Mark, and then I'll go to Doug, and then I'll go to Terry.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I think and Doug will speak. I think what we're trying to do here is just to be inclusive in the list under option two to fill out the four names of the states. Sorry, I just went blacked out. Fill in the four names of the states as this is currently configured. And then in the next discussion we have to have, try to nuance the, and I think Doug has a motion to the effect to define what a state permit bank is and how it does or does not comport with the sector definitions that are in Amendment 16. I think this action is just to try to complete the list and then to move to the next level of discussion, which may or not be frameworkable. That's what I thought we were doing. But
would it make sense for this framework to actually define what a permit bank is, as far as the council's concerned? Doug?
Yeah. What we're trying to do here in general is cover all our potential options here. This is something new that the states, quite frankly, are struggling with how to implement. One of the concerns my attorney general has, because it says the permits that we own have to be in a sector, is how can the state be jointly and severably liable and be in a sector? So the first way that we're trying to address this is, okay, we'll have our own lease-only sectors, and we'll see if we can deal with the rule of three somehow with that. I don't know. That's one option. The putting the word permit bank on there is just, it's like Harvest Sector 3. You know, we use that as a title for it, but these are going to be lease-only sectors. Then in the next motion, after we dispense with these motions, there is a motion by the committee to try and implement the concept of a permit bank within our just a permit bank, not a sector, but a permit bank. Since that Groundfish meeting, we've had meetings with NOAA, the states, and we've come up with a definition for these permit banks and what they can actually do. And we want to include that. I have a motion to substitute to replace the original wording that's in the document here with something that includes the definition so that we can try and get in the concept of a permit bank and see if there's some way that we don't even have to be part of a sector to be able to give out our ACE to other sectors. So that's the two-pronged work. There's two strategies we have here, and we'll see which one works.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So your definition is going to deal strictly with state permit banks, not private permit banks.
Correct.
Okay. Had Terry next. Did you want to speak?
I can't add too much more other than the states are all very well aware of the one-year time period for submission. And, in fact, you know, Maine was the original pilot, we've been working on this for the agency now for almost 2 years. And we're at the point where late this fall, we anticipate actually being able to buy some permits. We'd sure like to be able to utilize them and help out our fleet in 2011 fishing year.
Anyone else in the council? Go to the audience. Anyone in the audience? Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, Council, this amendment here, or whatever this is that we're voting on, in the hand gear A permits, will go as stated, 300 pounds per trip till our quota is caught. Is that my understanding?
Right. I mean, this is, just so you understand where we are in the process, if we vote yes on this, it doesn't mean you can go today and go catch 300
pounds. No, I understand
that.
Okay. Now, fishing is basically
done
for the rest of
the year. It'll be part of the framework, and we're planning to finalize the vote have a final vote in November.
Yes. Okay.
Yep.
All right. I just would like to speak on behalf of the hand gear permit situation. If we don't get some relief in this fishery, we will be out of fisheries. If you're looking for diversification and you want to keep a traditional fishery that has been in existence since the start of the country, then we need some help. We need to be able to go fishing and be able to land enough fish to make the day's pay. That's all we're looking to do right now, is to status quo. 300 gets us by. Doesn't give us a much of a living, but it gets us by. And, you know, this is a friendly fishery. We catch codfish primarily, and anything that we catch that's not of legal size, we return to the ocean unharmed for the 99% of it. It's a good fishery, and it shouldn't be eliminated. So I'd like your consideration on this. Thank you.
Mark?
Mark Stenner, Hanger Fisherman. Just to clarify, are you asking for public comments on the addition or the entire package? Okay, thank you. You all know me. I'm a Hanger Fisherman, and what we're asking for is actually very restrictive. And it says when we go to zero, we stop retention of cod. And this is based on the history of hand gear fishermen, hand gear A permits. Seems like everybody's got their own history now, and they could pretty much do whatever they want with it within their history and their business plans. So this is very restrictive. It detaches us from the days at sea cod trip limits. And just so I could refresh your minds, before we went into this whole sector thing, the intent was as the cod stocks rebuilt, the days at sea, cod stocks, boats would get higher trip limits and automatically so would hand gear. That, with sectors, everything all changed. 98% of the fisheries and sectors, very little fishermen are fishing in the days at sea now. And unfortunately, in a race to fish, hand gear fishermen cannot compete against modern fishing practices. So, we've caught, I think, 1 metric ton of Gulf of Maine cod, a little more than 1 metric ton of Gulf of Maine cod for the entire hand gear fishery since, I believe, the start of the fishing year. Think of what happened. We just started in July, really, and we went to 100 pounds, and we were done. There's no more fisheries. So you talk about fleet diversity and white papers and everything, and the decision you're making now and at the next council meeting, you're going to make a decision whether you want to have a hand gear fishery or not. That's the decision you're making. And think very carefully about what you want to do. Do you want a future of a hand gear fishery? Do you want a hand gear fishery? Because there's many ways to get rid of us, so there's many ways to encourage this fishery. And by not doing this, you will have gotten rid of us, all hand gear fishermen. So think carefully, make a decision wisely. Status quo is unacceptable. We'll be gone. Thank you very much.
Anyone else on the motion on the board? Gibb?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gibb Brogan with Oceana. Just looking at the list of things to include in Framework 45, I noted on the first day you talked about, during your brief on the Executive Committee, you talked about changes to Amendment 16 to address the list of species that didn't get accountability measures that the regional administrator had highlighted in her letter, and that she advised that those measures be developed as quickly as possible. You said that there had been some discussion at the Executive Committee. Is there a reason that that's not being included in Framework 45? Is there a plan to get that taken care of?
My sense of that was that we can't work on those measures right now and get this action out by November, but our plan is to initiate another action to deal specifically with those AM requirements by 2012, May of 2012.
2012, okay. Great.
Yep.
One more question about the observer changes that was put in through Amendment 16. Have we gotten a ruling from General Counsel whether that can be done through a framework? That seems to be a significant portion of the monitoring program for the sectors, and to start tinkering with that, it seems like that's a fairly major change to the fishery. So whether that needs an amendment or not is a definite concern of ours. Thanks.
Which observer changes?
About the funding, to remove the requirement for ground fish vessels to pay for at-sea monitoring costs in 2012. There. That seems to be a fundamental part of the observer of the monitoring program, and that it was ramped in and designed very carefully in Amendment 16, and it seems to be backing away from that right now. It seems to be a significant change to the fishery. So okay. I just appreciate the comments of General Counsel on that one.
Thank you. Anyone else in the audience? Back to the council. Anything further on the motion to amend? Ready, David?
Yeah, I have a question on this whole permit bank issue. This appears to be one of those exquisite bureaucratic messes we get into. And I wonder if there isn't just a simpler way of dealing with this, which is to exempt state permit bank from some of the sector requirements, whether it's the council that does it or the service, I'm not sure. I'd be happy to take a vote to do it. But it just seems inherently impossible for states to comply with sector requirements. There's only one state. You can't have three entities unless you start somehow carving up the state and saying, in New Hampshire, I don't know, Rockingham County is one entity and Stratford County is another and Fish and Game is a third or something like that. It's still going to be some kind of bureaucratic sleight of hand. Personally, I would like a much simpler solution, which is a vote of this council to exempt states from certain sector administrative requirements. And I just throw that out there as a question and that hopefully somebody at the full council here can answer for me.
Pat?
Yeah, this is my fault because I thought this one wouldn't confuse the issue, but it obviously did. There's a discussion coming up on that, and I completely agree with you, and I think that that's sort of generally what's going to be recommended in some subsequent motions. So I confuse this by suggesting that this could be handled under this motion. This is nothing more than getting approval for the sector. So I think we will be talking about that shortly.
Okay, so I'll wait till the forthcoming motion for the answer. No problem. Thank you.
Anything further on the motion to amend? Ready for the question? All those in favor of the motion to amend, raise your hand. Abstentions, no votes, abstentions, motion carries 16-0-0. Now we're on the main motion as amended. Pat Kirkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the issue of the funding, option 3 under 1.5, from our perspective, that's not a viable option. You've got a funding, you've got a monitoring requirement, and you need a mechanism to fund that monitoring requirement. So my suggestion would be that the council not spend time pursuing that motion, that option.
Doug?
On another issue, if I can. The first part of this motion discusses closure from April to June in the Whaleback area, which I think is an excellent track that we're taking. My concern about this, and I'm going to, is that the first time that any of, at least I've seen this map was a week ago Monday when we got this in the mail. My concern is making sure that our recreational fleet, which has never been subject to any kind of closed areas up in the Gulf of Maine, is aware of this. And where we're meeting here to initiate a framework action in Newport and going to be approving it in Brewster, Mass., about as far away as you can get from that area, I think we need to do, first of all, I want to find out from Gene, because we've never closed an area on recreational fishermen in the Gulf of Maine, is this a frameworkable item? And if his answer is yes, if it's no, then obviously we can take it out. But if it's yes, I think it's going to be very important that we have a tremendous amount of public outreach by the council about this so that people can become aware of this. Because I know the recreational fleet up in our area, not the party boat, charter boat, because they're permitted and they're aware of it, but there's a large number of people up there that do fish in that area, and to suddenly blindside them in May when they're normally going out there to fish in that area without making them aware of why and how we do it, and not having any public hearings, because in a framework action there isn't any public hearings, I think we're setting ourselves up for getting a black eye on it. While if we do this publicly and make them aware of it, we could come out being heroes on this. So first of all, I'd like to ask Gene, is this indeed a frameworkable item, given that we've never, ever put a closed area up there on recreational fishermen?
Well, I think it's a very close call. We've discussed this internally to some degree. You know, closed areas are measures that are in place, at least for some of the fishing fleet, if not for the recreational fleet. It's specifically defined measure in the frameworkable measure section in the that defines frameworkable measure. But I do, you know, so I think it technically could be construed as a frameworkable item, but I share your concerns that, you know, this is affecting sort of a new segment of the fishery in general that probably warrants more than a minimal opportunity for public involvement and comment than we might usually suggest for a framework. So I think the council should think very hard and carefully about whether they want to do this measure as a framework, even though I think it can be supported as a framework in a very close call, or whether this warrants a more, perhaps more public input and a more comprehensive review that may happen under an amendment.
Yeah, I understand the concern, but if you do look at the list of frameworkable items, you've got recreational measures can be adjusted, closed areas can be, our area-specific measures can be implemented, and I think the spawning protections are also in there. So it certainly seems like there's enough in the frameworkable items that would cover this type of action. But I do understand the concern.
Frank?
Yeah, I see the concern here, and I know that we've said that we would use size, season, and bag limits for mortality controls in the recreational. But I also know if you go back to Amendment 7, we have closed areas that do affect the recreational. Area 1 and 2 are still closed to the recreational, probably the only group that's not allowed in there. So it is something that has been used. And seeing how this is probably not a mortality control, it's more of the spawning area closure, I think you can use the justification that we have used closed areas in the past.
but I think there's probably enough concern either way, but it's not like we've never used them.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to add to what Frank said, the state of Massachusetts did also make a spawning closure, which was within state waters. So, you know, if we do go ahead with this, maybe we need to work with them or get some of how they went out to the public with that, because I think it was done relatively relatively quickly as well, because it was a same sort of situation where the spawning aggregations were just getting very heavily hit.
Doug.
Is there some way, you know, I'm hearing that, I guess we could put it in because it has been done in the past, even though it hasn't been done in the Gulf of Maine, but it has been done in the state. Is there some way that the council, without having a formal public hearing, between now and the next meeting could hold a informational meeting on this and try and advertise it as best we can to get, again, I want this, I think this is a great measure. I think it should be in there. But if we go through with this and approve this here and then finally put it in, implement it, approve it for implementation in Brewster, Mass., I think we're setting ourselves up for a black eye here when it could be something that's going to make us be heroes if we do this right. And so, to me, there's really got to be some kind of public process for this to get it out. Is there a way that we could have an informational hearing at the Urban Forestry Center or someplace in northern Massachusetts between now and in November?
First of all, Doug, Brewster's not a bad place.
It's a lovely place. It's just a long ways from New Hampshire.
I hear you. And I think Paul Howard wants to address your concern.
You know, I'll work with staff quickly to determine what we can and can't do as far as having the experts there. But, you know, if there's state directors and other people willing to chair some meetings, and, you know, it's pretty straightforward what we're trying to do. But we can go out with a number of press releases, radio, Coast Guard notice to mariners, whatever we have to do to just announce we've got some action going on and where the final action will be. We can do that. So I'll get something back to the council.
Thank you.
You can cut a TV commercial, Doug. Anything further on the motion? Gene? Or Pat?
I was just going to point out a couple other measures that I think present questions about whether they're frameworkable. And one is the hand gear A permit program, which seems to be quasi-allocative, if not directly allocative. It's sort of setting up a sector-like program with vessels having an overall TAC that shuts down the fishery in a way that, you know, I don't think there's a correlation of measures that exist that would be a sufficient antecedent to call this an adjustment of an existing measure. It seems to be creating a new type of group that's allocated a specific amount of fish that they can fish under. So based on the newness of the type of group and the allocative nature of it, this may be more appropriate for an amendment rather than a framework. And the other, we can talk about the state exceptions to the state, to sector requirements regarding state sectors when we get to that issue.
Anything to what Gene said? Any concerns or any action a council member wants to take at this time? Frank?
Gene, I understand what you're saying. They were saying it would be separate, but prior to this, what was the Gulf of Maine, 800-pound trip limit? We started the year, and the hand gear was still only 300. So we already had a separate regulation in place for the hand gear. So now...
Well, but it's, as I understand it, this is creating a TAC for the hand gear group, keeping them at 300 pounds regardless of what other segments of the fishery might be reduced to in terms of trip limits. So it's carving out an exception for this group with an overall TAC, which is a new approach for this segment of the fishery.
Yeah, but if I can, I think when you reduce the trip limit down to the 100 pounds, you're trying to determine, I don't want to put words in the regional administrator, but you're trying to determine what trip limit you need to not exceed your ACL for the year. So, I mean, by bringing the trip limit down to 100 pounds and leaving this at 300, the likelihood is still, if you're only landing 1 or 2 metric tons, I don't see where it's giving them a separate ACL. It would come out of the determination that leaving them at 300 and the rest of the trip limit was at 100, or when it goes down to 50, that you're still not going to exceed your ACL.
Well, maybe I'm not understanding what the intent of this was. My understanding was they would be given an ACL that, when reached, would shut down this fishery. Not just a estimate.
My understanding is it's not a separate ACL. It's that when it goes to zero for everybody, it goes to zero for them as well. When it's caught, maybe I'm wrong. Hang on.
Inherited. To know, and this may depend on what the final version of this is too.
I got Tom Neese.
Yeah, just a couple quick clarifications. It basically says that we calculate based on the potential sector contribution of what the hand gear A permits have, because they all have a PSC. You calculate how many pounds of Gulf of Maine cod that turns into, and when they catch that much Gulf of Maine cod, their Gulf of Maine cod trip limit goes to zero. As currently worded, it doesn't say they stop fishing. It says their Gulf of Maine cod trip limit goes to zero. Which they do land some haddock, so not much.
Dave?
Pass. Tom said what I was going to say.
Terry? Pass. Anything further? Pat?
So on that issue, I would encourage the committee to look again at the way that this is crafted, because I do think when you look at the language, it's a sub-ACL kind of approach. But my issue was back to the funding issue. I don't know if that's also something that you would recommend, Mr. Chairman, we pursue with the committee. As I said, I don't think the option that's in here is viable. Certainly, we're supportive of getting additional funding to continue the support we've provided in this fishery, but don't have a lot of control over that. And so if, in fact, we don't have the funding, which is what this... So if we do have the funding, then we would pay out that additional year. And if we don't have the funding, then what this implies is that nobody pays for it. I hate to use the word approvable, but let's just say I'm thinking about this the approvability of this, and I'm struggling with it. but we can, if you'd like, just pursue it with the committee, and then if we need to, at the next council meeting as well.
What are we thinking about in terms of a number of committee meetings? 1 or 2 between now and November, or just one? One? Okay. So, and then we're looking for approval at the November council meeting. So I think, I mean, I hear what you're saying. You're saying at the very least you want to see another alternative in here that says some sort of hybrid, or you want to see this go away altogether. Yeah. So, I mean, that's really, I think the council needs to decide that today rather than rely on the committee to come to their own senses, I guess, and pull it out at the committee level. I think if the council wants to act on that today, that's what we should do. Mary Beth?
Well, I think we need to think about what the alternatives would be to it going away, because I wouldn't support it going away. And my understanding was that in Amendment 16, it says that in the year, are we talking about 2012? 2012, that the industry will be required to pay for all monitoring. And what Pat just said was that if they have funds, that they would pay for some monitoring. So I'm not sure what the how to resolve it, but I would be looking for some different alternative, not having it totally go away.
Rip?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Pat, if I have the option three up in front of me. It says, absent further action, industry will be responsible for the portion of these costs not funded by NIMS in fishing year 2013. If we change that three to a two, do you still have an objection?
Not funded by NIMS in 2012. No, I don't think it's necessary, but I don't have an objection.
Dave Gaethel.
Yeah, the issue here revolves around one word, will, W-I-L-L. As long as that word is in Amendment 16, basically when people outside the council process go to Washington and talk to legislators and others who might provide funding, people look at the document and say, well, our hands are tied. It says you have to do it. What we're saying is remove that word, and then if the funding isn't forthcoming, we can have a negotiation about how to pay for it. But as long as that word's in there, there's no negotiation, because it just says here, you guys pay for it, you deal with it. And what is becoming very obvious is that the cost of observers is more than a lot of vessels gross in a day. And if the industry will have to pay for it, then the industry will not be able to fish. So, I don't support changing this. I think we have to change this now. We have to send a message early enough to the powers that be that you have to deal with this situation. And, you know, if we don't do that, then we're going to be caught in one of these situations that we get into where we're wrapped around the language and can't get ourselves unstuck because it's too late. So, you know, I do take a different view than Pat does. I understand why the agency doesn't want the word removed, because it, you know, puts them in an uncomfortable position. But if the word isn't removed, then I guarantee you in 2012 somebody's going to coming down and handing you a bill. And if we remove the word, then somebody's going to come down and offer to negotiate with you about how big that bill should be. And, you know, if it comes out that observers are that important, that, you know, the money has to come a little bit from both, and, you know, something has to happen on the services side that cuts into their budget some to pay for it, well, I'm sorry, that hurts. But, that, you know, that's no different than telling the fisherman, well, you get a bill for $1,300 for an observer today. I'm sorry, you only gross $900. You know, fork over your fish and $400 more. So I do disagree, and I would urge you to keep this in the framework.
Maybe this is semantics. This does not put us in a difficult position at all. The will does not. The reason I said to Rip that I didn't think it was necessary is because right now it says the industry will pay for dockside monitoring, and we're paying for it. And we're paying for it because we have the funding. And so we're not interpreting that will as you have to, even if we could. And we wouldn't interpret it that way for the at-sea monitoring funding either. But I don't have any objection to clarifying the wording to say in the absence of federal funding, the industry will. But what you cannot do is put in something that says that the agency will. That is disapprovable. Because the position of the agency is that if the funding is not available, the council can't recommend it. They can't put in a measure that requires it.
David.
I don't think the problem's with the agency, Pat. The problem is with other with funding sources who read Amendment 16 and say, well, why should we include money in the budget for 2012 to pay for observers when the document says that the industry will pay for it? That's the problem. It's not with how your folks interpret it. It's how other people are interpreting it. They're not willing to even talk about putting money in appropriation because they feel the language is so clear that it's already a done deal. And they're putting money there will you know, I don't think want to say waste of money, but it won't get put to the problem. So it is a language problem. And it's not a language problem with the service, it's a language problem with other people in Washington.
Well, I think the committee's going to have to spend a lot of time on this one. In the sense that the council's going to make a motion to remove this from the document right now, so I think it's going to end up going back to the committee. And I'm not sure we're going to come up with a hybrid solution today, but like we're all on notice. We've had this discussion, and this, you know, the service is telling us this can't be the only option that comes back, and the council's not necessarily going to have a easy time of getting it approved if that's what we forward in November. Pep.
I think we could, instead of having a motion that totally removes, I do think if it's just a language issue, we could have a motion that says revise option three to say in the absence of federal funding, the industry will be responsible for the cost. And then maybe the committee won't have to wrestle with it. I can make that motion.
So that's a motion. Okay, so I guess, Tom, you've got it? Okay. The The intent of the amendment is to replace option 3 with this language. According to the maker of the motion, instead of it saying, right.
I think replace option 3 in section 1.5.
Is there a second? Seconded by Frank Plount. Okay, discussion on the motion to amend. Sally?
I just ask if the council could take a look at under the Groundfish tab document number 6, which is the meeting summary from September 9th. And on page 9 of that document, there was a motion that I offered, and it failed by 3-5, that was trying to get to this point. It didn't. The motion read to include in Framework 45 an option to pay for at-sea monitoring through cost sharing between NIMS and the industry, in addition to the previous option, which was the one that was replaced by the motion that's on the table right now. But I would suggest that maybe an approach to take by the committee, if this motion passes, which I'm going to support, is that the committee could consider phasing in a cost share over time and specify the years over which the phase-in would take place and the maximum percentage that the cost share would be between between industry and the agency. I just saw Pat's hand go up, so maybe that's not a good suggestion. I don't know. I'm trying to put some ideas out there, knowing that we're in a crunch here with 5 weeks until the final vote on this, so that the council can have some discussion about some potential specifics, so we don't end up just staring at each other blankly around the committee meeting table when we get together in a few weeks.
Pat.
Yeah, and I do appreciate that, but I'm trying to avoid the committee spending a lot of time on this, too, and coming up with other options that aren't any more viable, and any option that actually requires the federal government to provide funding that isn't available wouldn't be an approvable option. So a cost-sharing arrangement doesn't work either. I mean, I really hope this funding continues. We've stretched it into 2011. I'm pretty confident that we'll be able to get through 2011 if the funding doesn't change a lot between 2010 and 2011. We'll be able to stretch it into 2012. It's just not guaranteed, and if we don't have it, we don't have it either. So cost sharing doesn't work either.
Doug.
I understand where the service is coming on this, but I can't support this motion. I, along with probably some of our other state agencies, have been working very hard with our congressional delegations to make sure NIMS does have funding for years to come to pay for the monitoring program of this program. I feel very strongly that that is an important role of the federal government in this kind of a program. I might waffle here and abstain on it, but I can't support it just on a basic philosophy standpoint.
Mary Beth.
I also am not going to support the motion, but I would think that it is something the committee needs to think about and discuss.
Okay. Anyone want to speak to support the motion? You ready for the question on the motion to amend? All those in favor, raise your hand. 5. Opposed? Eleven. Motion to amend fails 5-11. We're back on the main motion. Pat?
So I just want to be very clear here. The motion as it is in the document right now is not approvable. So I don't want anybody to be surprised by that.
You said that, yep. You're on the record, I think, four times. No. That's very clear. Frank?
Question to the service then, or to Pat. Does that make the framework not approvable, or just that portion of it?
That we would have to make a determination about whether it is severable or not. And let me give you my legal opinion. My initial reaction would be it probably is, but Gene may want to weigh in.
Right. I mean, it's by disapproving it, it's just status quo, right? So unless this is somehow fundamentally intertwined with the other measures, that the other measures aren't going to work, but for passing this suggested change, then it should be severable. It's just basically maintaining status quo.
Okay, back on the main motion. Anything further on the main motion? You ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Opposed? 2. Motion carries 14-2. Frank?
Okay, just so I'm clear here when we go back to committee, the 300-pound issue is going back to committee to be addressed, or it's going forward the way it is? It's going forward the way, okay. Next motion, Karen, should be the long one. A state-operated permit bank sponsored by NOAA shall be considered a sector for the inclusion purpose of transferring ACE to qualified sectors. Such permit banks will be allocated ACE for the fishing year based on the PSEs of the permits owned by the permit bank that are declared as ACE permits for the fishing year. All or a portion of the permit bank's ACE for any Northeast multi-species stock may be transferred to a qualifying sector at any time during the fishing year. Permit banks may only act as the transfer in an ACE transfer. And it doesn't need a second because it's a committee motion, and before it could get seconded, there'll probably be a motion to amend or so. That's the committee motion.
Doug.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a motion to substitute, and if Karen can put that up, I'll try and read that. It'll take just as long as it took Frank to read the other one. And if I get a second, I'd like to speak to it. My motion is to substitute the first paragraph under Option 2 of Section 1.7 with the following. A state-operated permit bank sponsored by NOAA is defined as a partnership between NOAA and one or more states in which federal grant funds are used by the states to obtain federal fishing vessel permits so that the fishing access privilege associated with those permits may be allocated by the states to qualifying commercial fishermen according to the criteria in which NOAA and the states have agreed. I bet you can tell that 5 states and the federal government worked on that definition. NOAA-sponsored state permit banks are subject to the U.S. Department of Commerce regulations regarding program income such that any revenue generated by the permit banks may only be used to defray the program costs of operating the permit bank or must be returned to the federal government to reduce the amount of the initial grant award. Such entities shall be authorized to transfer ACE to sectors. All portions of the permit bank's ACE for any New England multi-species stock may be transferred to a sector at any time during the fishing year. Permit banks may only act as the transferor of ACE transfer.
Seconded by Terry Stockwell.
So, Mr. Chairman, this is, and council members, this is part two of how we're hoping that we can address the needs of these state-operated permit banks that are being funded by NOAA. What we're hoping is that by setting these up as specifically defined permit banks, that as the rationale under 1.7 states, we would be exempt from the reporting requirements, record keeping, et cetera, and not have to deal with the the limit of three, needing the minimum of three being in there, because we wouldn't be a sector, we would be a permit bank, but we would be authorized to transfer ACE out of our permits. With that, I'll take any questions.
I have a few. I'm not trying to be difficult. I think it's, for me, it's just terminology. You just described it, I think, as state-operated, NOAA-funded, and I've seen, I think in documents, it described as NOAA-sponsored, state-operated. And I'm also curious, what happens if a state decides it wants to put money into its permit bank and begin to buy permits?
In our MOAs, I believe we have the opportunity to do that, but under different conditions. We have certain specific conditions in our MOA with the service that we must comply with on this. And so clearly this says this is sponsored by the state-operated permit bank that's sponsored by NOAA, or you can say NOAA-sponsored state permit bank. It's just the way we, I think that's the semantics.
Yeah, I guess my concern was, and I mean, I guess I can understand if you were to generate a profit, per se, that they would want the funds back, right, because it's kind of like a grant, right? You want to fund back into the main pot, and the service may want to redistribute at some point. But I'm just curious what happens if you generate funds through investments on dollars that the state puts into the bank. Is there a way for you to separate those funds?
I haven't come to that because I know in New Hampshire, you know, as I say, we're not a poor state, we're a cheap state. I doubt that that's ever going to happen, but there might be some opportunities. But clearly this is what we're talking about, is the whatever the permit bank that we have established with the help of NOAA, as a partnership with NOAA.
Hey, I'll end my line of questioning. I'll talk to you offline. Mark.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. To that point, we have to have this in there because any of it would be considered grant program income, and because we have, you know, a grant, we're going to have to, you know, abide by those terms. To the extent that states do endow their permit banks with some resources, I think that's going to be possible, but we would have to maintain the accounting stream to clearly demonstrate how those funds are being used to ensure that the federally endowed funds are used in accordance with the MOA and the grant, and state funds might have a broader utilization. For example, in Rhode Island, we might be interested in acquiring permits that are endowed with mid-Atlantic species. So we've talked about that. It will require some accounting, but I think we can do that.
Paul Howard.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I thought Sally had a great idea this morning when she said that, you know, when we start to look at priorities, we should be looking at permit banks and community fishing associations and things like that. And David Gafel mentioned this is another one of these areas where, you know, it might come back and bite us down the line because we don't know really what we're doing. It's virgin territory. And I think that, you know, I don't know if we have any goals and objectives. I know we talk about permit banks for communities, so we should have some goals and objectives for permit banks, whether they're state or private, and how do you handle them differently and why do you? And once you have those goals and objectives, then you need some rules or some measures to make sure that those goals and objectives are met. You know, we talked this morning about limited amount of general category, and we wanted to maintain those communities. But one permit bank could change the general category fleet for forever. And I submit it could change the groundfish fleet forever with all the private money and now federal money. And all you need is one rogue senator to put $50 million in a line item, and then you could really upset the balance of power. So I think we need a good we need to get a handle on it. We need some asset, or what do you call it, allocation shares, some limits on allocation. We need to really get a handle on this before, and I think we have some time because I think we have some time. We don't have time. But anyway, I'm... enough said.
Tom Neese.
I'm not sure the question the chair asked got answered, because when I read this definition, it creates a structure for a permit bank that's using NOAA grant funds. It doesn't indicate whether that structure can use funds from another entity. It doesn't create anything that's a separate state-funded permit bank entity. So, I mean, it's questionable in my mind whether this authorizes a state to use its own money to buy permits and then sell it. But I think more importantly, I don't know if we want to get it down into the weeds on these issues until we've heard from NOAA General Counsel whether this type of thing can be done in a framework.
It took 2 years to develop an MOA. We made record time in a month and a half developing this definition. To Paul's question, I mean, the objectives of the MOAs are to secure continued access to fishery resources for small-scale local fishermen from small fishing communities for a state of Maine throughout Maine, to create and protect sustainable local fisheries, to supplement existing access rights held by fishermen in small Maine communities, and to mitigate the efforts of fishing effort consolidation on small-scale fishermen and rural fishing communities in Maine. This is a very focused program right now. It's in the grand scheme of things, it's not a whole lot of money, but it's a first big step. We're struggling on how to take the funds we've received through working with the agency and have them help some people that really need some help in these little communities. As Doug started to say, maybe New Hampshire's cheap, but Maine's broke, and I think the other states are too. There's no likelihood that there's going to be any state money coming into this permit bank for the foreseeable number of years. And I absolutely agree with Paul. I think we need to have, depending upon what our council priorities are, some kind of workshop that looks at permit banks and where we're going to go from the 30,000-foot level sometime, hopefully in the early winter. But we, in order to utilize the federal funds and start helping these fishermen in fishing year 2011, we need some kind of action in this framework to move this ahead.
Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to ask Council to give us some advice as to whether we can actually do this in a framework.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to have all the wet blankets over here in this corner. And before I address this, what I'm going to say has nothing to do with the concept here or whether this is an appropriate way to deal with these state permit banks. I think it's perfectly fine to consider and the council to consider this kind of action and to adopt it. My concern is that it is not, I don't see this as a frameworkable item. I can see it going in an amendment, maybe a one-off amendment that only focuses on this. That would be, and I know the staff or the council or the agency are not going to like me for this, but if you have a very singular one-purpose amendment, then you could perhaps get this done you know, in a more timely way than you would normally think for an amendment. But I think this concept is in both motions that are up here, the original one and the one that's being proposed as a substitute, are just change fundamentally the underpinnings of sectors. It creates exceptions to sectors that go beyond just an adjustment of a measure. It actually exempts these state permit banks from meeting the eligibility requirements, and then to be able to act in some ways like a sector, in some ways not like a sector. So it's creating a very new type of entity that was not discussed or analyzed or contemplated in Amendment 16. And for that reason, this kind of measure is not appropriate, in my opinion, for a framework measure, and that you might want to consider doing a very singular purpose amendment to get this done as quickly as possible, or the states may want to look at entering into a sector agreement with other vessels and to try to get around the joint and several liability problem by setting up an operations plan that does not allow these other vessels to fish, that they can only lease the history that they're bringing into the sector, or something along those lines. Thank you.
Mr. Libby?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I had a slightly different question, but it pertains to this. It says the permit banks will be considered a sector for the exchange purpose of transferring ACE to qualifying sectors. Does that mean there's no days at sea transfer from these permit banks?
We had a I had a little bird whisper back in my ear. We've had that in that and then out, and now I've been told it needs to be back in there, so that I was about ready to asked to put in a friendly amendment to say transfer ACE or days at sea to sectors. And I apologize for the, I was getting conflicting advice here on whether that needed to be in. And in this version it was out, but I guess now it needs to be back in. But I was thinking about arguing with Gene, but I guess that's a mistake, arguing with a lawyer at 5 o'clock on a Thursday.
Yeah, I don't think you have to. Wouldn't have to amend to put the day thing in now. I think it can happen at the committee level. Just, you know, and
as long as my counterparts on the committee remember to put that in.
I think we have a broader issue to talk about, which is what General Counsel just mentioned. I'm not sure where to start there, other than to say his recommendation is that it's not something we should framework. But Mark,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I think we kind of thought that was coming, but I mean the idea that we're going to have a single issue facet amendment, my experience, that's going to happen. All kind of things are going to get hung on that as soon as the amendment box gets opened up. So I really don't. Well, I recognize the, you know, the legal advice. I just don't think that the amendment is the way to get us where we need to go. So I don't know what Doug thinks about it and where we could go from here, but I don't think amendments to the action, I don't think that's going to be narrow enough and quick enough to get us what we need.
Well,
sorry, Mark, I was in the sidebar. You were asking for Doug?
So my response is I hear exactly where you're coming from. If it was the five state directors here that were putting together that amendment, we could get it through pretty darn quick. But You know, there's always, there's so many issues surrounding groundfish that it does act like a magnet the minute you say amendment, and there's all sorts of people. I don't know if there's a way that we can, as a council, focus on it and not have anything attached to it, but at least in my brief tenure here, even when we've tried to go that direction, it hasn't happened. But if there's some other way to do it, we tried to get away from the concept of this was a sector because we think it is something totally different. It's a permit bank, and we're just asking that that permit bank has the ability to transfer the ACE it has to and days at sea to the sector. It's not going to fish. It's just going to be holding it. We're just trying to get allocation to the people in the sector that need it. And it seems like there should be something relatively simple and quick that we can do to facilitate that.
Council? David?
Wheel myself back in here. Well, and just try this kind of as an idea. What would happen if the council simply made a measure or took a vote to allow the four states to form permit banks and in conjunction with NOAA? I mean, skip all this language, skip all this stuff. Just take a vote to do it.
I think we still have to go through rulemaking and all that. I don't think we can just decree that just because today, and on September 30th, we felt like the government in the four states or five states could... I mean, I hear you, but I just don't think we have that flexibility.
Well, I mean, you know, and I don't have the advantage of having what's frameworkable in front of us, and I don't want to debate Gene. I'm sure I'll lose in my present condition. But, I mean, that seems to be the only other alternative. You know, I agree with the state directors. Putting this into an amendment, you're looking at 2 or 3 years down the road. And we don't have that long to wait. We got to get this up and running in a year.
I mean, the difference between a framework and an amendment, it gets distorted. This council could pick a single issue amendment and could get it done almost as quickly as a framework. There are legal requirements for periods of time necessary for public comment and a few other things. So it takes longer than a framework per se, but it doesn't have to take 2, 3, 4, 5 years or 7 years. I mean, it can happen quicker than 2 years. It can happen in a year.
All right. For example, can we suspend scoping?
If you need scoping for it in the, I mean, if it requires an EIS, scoping is only necessary for EISs. So if this measure as included in a framework requires an EIS, then you have to do scoping for the framework. The amendment doesn't make it, doesn't require an EIS. Amendment can be done with an EA if it meets the NEPA requirements and provisions. So if in its current state in this motion, if an EA is ultimately deemed sufficient, you know, after you look at it and have a finding of no significant impact, then it's not necessary for the amendment either. Just calling an amendment doesn't mean that it has to go through an EIS process.
Okay, well, let me try one last thing then. Knowing that we're going to set priorities in November and knowing you don't want to initiate an amendment today when you're setting priorities in November, could we initiate an amendment today to deal with state permit banks and take a vote on it right now while everybody's of a uniform mind that's it. That's all it has in it is permit banks so that it doesn't even get a chance to get larded up before we get out of this room.
Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dave must have read my mind. I would like to make a motion to table this motion.
Is there a second? Seconded, non-debatable. All those in favor of tabling the motion, raise your hand.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7,
10 in favor. Opposed? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Motion to table carries 10 to 5. Rip.
I'd like to make a motion that we start, initiate amendment, whatever it is, to the groundfish plan for the single purpose of dealing with state-operated permit banks. And, well, if we get a second on that, then I'll...
Is there a second? Dave Gaethel? Rip?
My intention would be that if this passes, then we have an upcoming, fairly soon upcoming, executive committee meeting. We will be discussing priorities at that point, and we will see how we can fit this in to proceed with it.
Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just as a off-the-cuff idea, would it be of an advantage to assign this to an ad hoc committee of the state directors, of the state representatives? Would that expedite it to do it that way?
I would think that would be one that's a good suggestion, one that we can discuss at the executive committee meeting. Maybe some of us can discuss it with some of the state directors prior to that.
I'll volunteer for that committee.
Okay. Anything further on the motion, Mark?
Well, just to that point, we certainly, Rhode Island will contribute whatever resources you need from us to help with that. I just have to say that I appreciate the effort. I'm just not confident that language is going to stop anybody from during the process adding. Moving to amend and add other items to it. It's happened before, and it'll probably happen again, but we'll do the best we can. Thanks.
Terry?
Yeah, thank you, Rip, for making that motion. I think if we all put our minds to it, we can address the other issues in a separate and concurrent amendment.
Yeah, go to the audience. Anyone in the audience? Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bob Ballou with Rhode Island DEM. I'm just wondering if it's the sense of the council that by moving in this direction, it precludes what I guess might be referred to as option A, and that is the four states trying to work their way awkwardly through the formation of a sector, perhaps in combination, to pursue that perhaps in parallel fashion to this, or can the two go hand in hand, or is it the sense of the council that this would preclude that option A?
Yeah, I think they can go on parallel tracks because we did have the earlier motion that would approve potentially four new sectors. And so if the states work jointly to somehow operate maybe as one sector, it's awkward, but it's a potential, I think, interim solution.
Anyone else? Back to the council. Frank?
Point of order, and I think the motion to table was the motion to substitute the table, so we would still have the other motion. Unless it was to table both.
We took two votes. We took two votes.
Okay, yeah, I would make a motion that we table the initial motion.
as well.
Second.
Seconded by Frank. Let's just stay on the motion, the amendment motion. All right. I hear your point of order. I see the table motion. Can you withdraw that motion to table? The second one. Let's just stay on this amendment. Or this motion to initiate the amendment. Anything further from the council? Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Frank.
Okay. That's all I have for Framework 45. Next, we have a presentation on accumulation caps, a white paper, and we have a motion on that. I'll have a motion after the presentation. I can put the motion up and then. Yeah, okay. The committee recommends, based on this report, the establishment of individual accumulation caps for this fishery and the next appropriate action. Which will not be the amendment that we just started. That's a committee motion, so.
Mary Beth.
I think there are a couple issues with Framework 45. I know that Jimmy had one. I had one. Do you want to take them before we move on?
Oh, you have more issues on 45?
Issues on 45 now?
Yeah, before we move away from 45. I didn't realize that anybody else had anything else to say about 45.
Yeah. Well, mine is kind of minor, so I think I'd defer to Jim first.
Yeah, put this motion aside for a second. I'm struggling right now. My brain's fried. Jimmy?
Yeah, I hate to do this, but I would like to offer an additional option in Framework 45 under the revised Georges Bank Yellowtail Flounder Rebuilding Mortality Target Section 1.1.2. And I'd like to offer a motion to have a sub-box option D. And the motion will be that the Georges Bank rebuilds will be by 2019 at a 60% probability of success level. Period. And the rationale for this is that getting the new data from the track and looking at it, if we think we're going to accomplish our goal of any of those options by 2016, we're kidding ourselves. Because if you read them, if you take a realistic approach on recruitment, a realistic look at the recruitment, that recent recruitment will not allow us to get there under any of those levels. So I think it's just wrong for us to continuously try to pick goals that we have pretty good knowledge we're not going to get to. So it'll be. Sorry, it's late but we didn't get this information until recently.
Is there a second? Mary Beth. Discussion. Pat.
I'm confused. I guess it goes beyond the 10 years. So well, you can't. And in fact, I think there's a typo in the option one. Okay. but 2016 is the limit of where we could go.
Other people have extended rebuilds when they find out that they have situations that they can't meet. And I believe we have that situation. And we continuously do this to ourselves. So, I mean, we can vote it down, but we can't meet that goal. We're not going to meet it. We are not going to meet 2016.
Mary Beth.
There is a similar situation in the North Pacific on snow crab, and they determined that they are not going to meet their 10-year rebuilding time frame. And the analysis is on their web page, and it is scheduled for their meeting of next week. And the analysis being presented to the council, clearly we don't know what direction they will go in, is to restart the clock, a whole new 10-year period. So they couldn't meet the 10-year rebuild, and the analysis is going to look at it takes them through 2019, I think. And which doesn't mean that's the option they'll choose, but the data they're going to look at, I mean, they must assume that they can do it. They've already done the analysis.
Anything further on the motion? Anyone in the audience? Richie?
Rich Kanash, to Whelan City Auction. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do support this motion. And Jimmy is right. We're never going to reach this goal. So who's kidding who? Last year, we left $40 million of scallops in the ocean that could have been harvested because of yellowtail. This year, with the prices, is $60 million of scallops in the ocean that could have been harvested because of yellowtail. We have about 15 vessels in New Bedford tied up, sold their allocation, who could be fishing because of yellowtail. And the majority of the fleet in New Bedford, they're looking for ways to stay away from yellowtail, to avoid yellowtail, in order to keep fishing this year. Let's face it, we're not going to meet that goal. We're never going to catch, we're never going to rebuild to the levels where we're supposed to be at. And if we don't restart it, we're going to have the same problem next year. Thanks.
Vito.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Vito Giglione, Northeast Seafood Coalition. Just wanted to remind us that we didn't reach agreement on yellowtail last year with the TMGC, that the ABC was 5,000 metric ton, and we ended up settling with around 1,300. I think this year it's 1,900. And these are concessions being made continuously by the Canadians, and once they decide to have a fishery on yellowtail, they're not going to tolerate these types of gaps between the ABC and what you come out with for F rebuild. So anything we can do to add options for being able to have a realistic goal for Georgia's yellowtail is going to be critical. And I would ask maybe that we look to have General Counsel actually look into that snow crab example. We're all working under the same agency laws, so hopefully if there's something there that we can draw from and use, then there's precedent in Magnuson that it's been done. But this is a stock that is not, we've been under a high attack on this even in Amendment 13. So this is a stock that we have not exceeded a target catch for nearly a decade, yet we can't get there from here. So I think we have some pretty strong information that shows that, you know, there's new scientific information that shows we need to look at a different rebuilding period. So let's see if Gene can put a wet blanket on the 10-year rebuilding.
All right, back to the council. Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had a question for the maker, if that's okay. Jim, I'm just curious as to why 60% rather than 50.
Just to be a little more cautious, basically.
Anything further from the council? Tom Neese.
I
I think this creates some technical problems with trying to analyze this, and I guess I'd look for a little bit more elaboration from the council as to why they know they're not going to get to the target.
Well, the only way to get to the target would be having recruitment that we haven't seen for a few years. And I just, I mean, if you get lucky, you might get there, but I think if you use a more realistic recruitment, you find that you can't get there. That's current recruitment levels.
This is going to create some technical issues, I think, that we're going to have to work through with the Science Center. I mean, because there are some analyses, for example, in the Yellowtail Flounder Track report, the Canadian reference document, that suggest that you may not get to the rebuilding target by the years Jim's talking about if the recruitment's a problem. But those same analyses say you won't get to the rebuilding target. We won't get to the rebuilding target, I think, perhaps even later than 2016 if recruitment's an issue. And this all relates to the SSC recommendation that if recruitment's an issue, it's not just a question of your rebuilding period, it's a question of your rebuilding target. And, you know, adjusting the length of the rebuilding program doesn't adjust the rebuilding target. And the only mechanism we have for adjusting the rebuilding target is through a benchmark assessment. And, bluntly, we don't have a benchmark assessment plan for Georges Bank Yellowtail anytime soon. So, you know, I understand the reasoning that, you know, you have to believe in the tooth fairy to think you're going to rebuild by 2016, given the recruitment we've seen the last few years. But it's going to be maybe the thing to do is to take a look at this harder before November and see what sort of rationale we can come up with to try and justify it. But I just want to be clear that it's going to create some very strange things for us when we try and look at the best assessment scientists we have in front of us and try and shoehorn this into it.
Oh, we're used to strange things, so. Pat?
George isn't here, but I did at one point ask him to look into the snow crab action, and I can't recall. It's a difference. I recall that it's a different situation. I can't recall the specifics of it, so we will certainly look at it again. But I don't believe it was simply a situation where they said, well, we're not going to get to the 10 years, so we're going to start all over again. The only reason that I'm aware of that anyone nationwide has been able to sort of reset the clock or add years to the clock more accurately is when it was determined that, in fact, when you implemented the management measures, you could not have rebuilt within 10 years. And so, for example, we looked at this for winter flounder and made the determination that that was not the case. And I would be surprised if it's the case in this situation either, but we'll look at the snow crab situation again. I am going to vote no on the motion, though.
Anything further? David?
Yeah, just quickly, I mean, the report we just got, page 19 and page 20 in the slides, says rebuilding target cannot be achieved by 2014. I know that's not the Jake Jim has. Even with no fishing, using more realistic recruitment, i.e. lower, the probability of achieving U.S. rebuilding targets was further reduced. And then in the next slide, it says USA requirements for rebuilding not attainable with current productivity. That was the report we just got. So, you know, I think Jimmy's correct. That,
no.
And whether this is the right date or not, I can't say. But the dates we currently have, even with zero fishing, we can't do it.
The track report is referring to the 2014 75% rebuilding period. It's not referring to the alternatives for 2016 in that document. There's other sensitivity analyses that examine the 2016 in the reference document.
OK. Okay, I think we've had a healthy enough debate on this one. I'm ready to call a question. All those in favor, raise your hand. None. Opposed? Seven. 9-7. Abstentions? Motion carries 9-7. Anything else under 45 before we move on? Mary Beth.
I just had one issue. I'm not sure that it really needs to be added as an alternative, but perhaps some clarification in the framework. We got a letter from the agency at our last committee meeting, and they covered several issues, but one of them was the way in which history of canceled permits is dealt with. And so they did run into a situation where a couple of permits were canceled for some reason in 2010. And when they looked at what to do about that history, because of the way it was set up in Amendment 16, it flowed to the common pool and wasn't redistributed amongst everybody in the fishery. So they raised the issue, and I can make a motion. I'm not sure that I guess I asked Pat if she'd like me to make a motion to just clarify how we'd like to treat the history and if you think this would solve the problem.
I think an easier way to deal with it was just to make sure that the committee has the letter that Pat sent to us available and address it at the committee meeting. But thanks for reminding me. I did have that written down. I didn't bring it up, though. Anything else under 45 before I push us along? Okay. I guess we're back to where we were before, which is a presentation. We're done with 45.
I guess the committee did talk about that letter at their committee meeting and said, we'll deal with this issue later. I don't know if later they meant later for Framework 45 or later they meant after Framework 45. So
yeah.
I guess the clarification is we meant later for Framework 45. Okay, got it.
Jimmy.
I just want to ask a question. Is that a policy call or does it have to be in an amendment? I mean, part of the framework on deciding what to do with that, with the canceled permits. I mean, does it have to go through the through the framework? That's what I'm asking.
I think it was a policy call because there wasn't any explicit regulation directing them to treat that quota any different way. To change it would require regulation. Otherwise, it's going to continue to flow into the common pool. And that's a discussion for the committee. Unless Pat wants to contradict me.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said.
I think you were agreeing. Yeah. Okay, Annie, fire it up.
Okay, this is a presentation on a draft white paper that was presented to the committee at their last meeting, and now it's gone out to the whole council, on fleet diversity allocation and excessive shares in the Northeast multi-species fishery. This was an effort that started in the Interspecies Committee in April, looking at the potential for accumulation limits for the groundfish fishery and also to look at baselines in the groundfish fishery with the implementation of sectors. This came out of a presentation from someone from the regional office. I can't remember, but these are the Magnuson-Stevens Act LAP provisions. The LAP provisions require that holders don't acquire an excessive share of privileges by establishing a maximum share and other measures necessary to prevent an inequitable concentration of shares. Sectors aren't LAPs, so they're not necessarily subject to these provisions, but these considerations may still be relevant for sectors. The Magnuson-Stevens Act doesn't define the terms excessive or inequitable, so that's really a policy call on the part of the council. And if these types of limits are set too high in a LAP fishery, there's potential antitrust concerns, but they're also considered a major vehicle for maintaining fleet characteristics within a fishery. And the issue of fleet consolidation has come up a lot. with the implementation of sectors in the ground fish fishery. Fleet consolidation can happen naturally or can be directed to achieve a desired outcome. And with consolidation, you have a trade-off between over-consolidation and fleet efficiency and the profitability of participants in the fleet. The policy question here is what constitutes an acceptable fleet size. There's some interest, obviously, in maintaining some character, such as geographic diversity or other characteristics of the current fleet, and to create more crew employment and economic benefits to communities. So the question is, should fleet characteristics be considered in considering whether to develop accumulation limits for the or to direct consolidation for the fishery? At the June council meeting in Portland, the council passed this motion to maintain inshore and offshore fleets, to maintain a diverse ground fish fishery, including gear types, vessel sizes, geographic location, and participation levels, to maintain a balance in the geographic distribution of landings to protect fishing communities and infrastructure, and to prohibit any person from acquiring excessive access to the resource in order to prevent extraction of disproportionate economic rents from other permit holders. As a result of this motion, we were already developing a white paper for the committee, but this motion guided the development of that white paper, which is still a draft white paper. This is the outline that we've done so far. We had originally presented an outline to the Ground Fish Committee, and this was the first two-thirds of the outline. The end had some sections on analysis of potential accumulation limits and how they would affect the economics of the fishery and the makeup of the fishery. The committee directed council staff and the PDT to develop the first two-thirds of this paper, which is what's now on the board, first to see what the conclusions were or to see what the information was, and then decided to perform the technical analysis later. So there is no analysis of the accumulation caps or diversity measures within the New England fleet specifically. The two major parts of the paper are ground fish fleet diversity, where we have definitions of fleet diversity used in other fisheries, or at least that was the goal, to find those. And then we described baselines for the Northeast ground fish fishery. And the second section was design considerations for accumulation limits, where we described different types of accumulation limits that are used in fisheries around the country, possible considerations for those accumulation limits, and the actual limits that have been implemented in other fisheries in the U.S. So we're going to go through this outline really briefly, just so everyone knows what's in the paper. I'm going to start with the first section. Tom's going to go over the baselines for the Northeast fishery that we compiled, and then we'll go back to the design considerations. In the section on definitions of fleet diversity, it was very difficult to find actual definitions of diversity in other fisheries, or at least in the management plans. Gear type, geographic area, and boat size were considered in some management decisions. Other types of diversity could also be considered, including fishing strategies, differences in output or product type and quality. However, we didn't really find those in management plans or decisions from other fisheries. It generally wasn't predefined at all, and in places where there were discussions of whether diversity should be defined, it was found to conflict with adaptive management strategies, and that was often a deterrent in defining fleet diversity. There's also a question here between fishing diversity and diversity of permit ownership. Those are sort of two separate issues that we tried to pull apart in the paper and show that those are two different concerns that the council or committee may want to look at in determining where to go with the development of accumulation limits if that's pursued. And the diversity of fishing strategies, in addition to gear type and geographic area in those ones, are that you have mobile and stationary strategies, resident versus non-resident fishing, full-time versus part-time fishing, and high capital input versus low capital input fisheries. All right, we'll move on to baselines.
So in June, the council identified six characteristics that they were interested in a council motion. And so we decided that we'd try and look at how can we describe changes in the fishery using those characteristics. We looked at two general time periods, basically before Amendment 5 and then after Amendment 5. There's some data issues before 1994, and so we only looked at certain years before 1994. We caution that we're not convinced that the data is entirely comparable in those two different time periods. And this leads to, you know, one last caveat. We can only use the data we have when we're talking about the older time periods, and we know there's some holes in there, so you've got to keep that in mind when you look at things. We decided to use a variety of metrics to try and describe these changes. Some of them are just simple summaries. A few of them, and that I'll get into, are based on some ecological indices of concentration or diversity that are used in other fields, including business and economics. But I think one of the key charts to pay attention to is this one. We were landing, you know, over 300 million pounds of groundfish in the early 80s by U.S. fishermen. Now we're landing less than 75 million pounds of groundfish. So I think, you know, when you start to look at the data, given the magnitude of changes in groundfish landings, it would be a miracle if we didn't see changes in how these landings were distributed. One of the first metrics we used is a fairly simple one but hard to explain, which is called species richness. This is taken from ecological studies where basically they count the number of species in an area, and it's just a number of how many different species they are. So what we did is we identified the number of gear, vessel size, and landing port groups. So, for example, vessels less than 30 feet landing in Downeast Maine using handline gear is one species, quote, unquote. With the categories we use, the maximum number is 460, and you can see that prior to 1994, it was relatively flat. In more recent years, 2001, species richness has generally declined. And generally, it's about 17 or 18% fewer combinations than now. This is not a terribly informative measure because if there's one boat that lands 1 pound of groundfish in Downeast Maine using hand lines, that counts as one. If there's 500 boats landing 22 million pounds in New Bedford using trawl gear, that counts as one. So, you know, it just shows you the number of categories they are. So there's other indices that are used both in management and science which takes into account, in essence, the share of each species that's in an area as the total. So, you know, five members of one species is worth more than one member of another species. I'm not going to go through the formula. It's in the document. This is a fairly common thing that's used both in economics, management, and ecology. But I'm going to walk you through some examples of how we combined some of these different indices in order to present a picture. The first example is groundfish landings by port group. This is designed to drive your eyes crazy more than anything else, but if you look at it in your package, it's a little easier to understand. Simple bar graph, stacked bar graph with the groundfish landings in pound by port group. These are the port groups that we've identified in Amendment 13. They're stacked on the bottom. They basically run north to south, I think. The legend on the right matches the order of the bar graphs. So with a little bit of effort, you can, for example, see the landings in Maine because you know which port groups are in Maine, and you can see the landings in Gloucester and the landings in some of the other ports. And if you look at this carefully, you can see that some of these bars, their proportion gets bigger and some of them get smaller. But, you know, you have to admit that's a little hard to look at this and see much meaningful. Now, another thing to point out is when you're reading the document, you'll see the red line right here, which indicates when the reporting system changed. You'll notice that these years are not necessarily every year. These are specific years that we looked at. They're also calendar years. After this red line, these are all fishing years, so we tried to distinguish the labels so you would remember that. So then we took this fancy index that I talked about, and when you do the index, you can see that it gets bigger. And the way this index is concentrated, if it gets bigger, it means that landings are becoming more concentrated, that they're becoming more concentrated in fewer port groups. That's all this line tells you. It doesn't really tell you where they went or how things changed. And so the next graph that you'll see in these categories does. This is just an extract from a graph. It's pretty easy to understand, though, when you first look at it, it's a little difficult. Each of these squares is one of our port groups. The red line is the median share that that port group had over the time period 1995 to 2008, I think, is the last year. And then each circle is what that port group had for a share. So, for example, if you look in Gloucester and North Shore area, you'll see that over time they had a relatively high proportion of the landings, and it actually has increased in the last few years. Landings, more groundfish landings as a proportion of the total landings, are being landed in Gloucester and the North Shore. You see New Bedford was showing an increase up until about 2004, 2005, then it's dropped down to the median level. You look at lower mid-coast Maine, which I think is the port group that Portland, Maine is in, and you can see that it went up a little in the mid-90s, and then it declined, and it's dropped well below the median here in later years. Now, this shouldn't be a surprise to anybody. All of this data has been talked about in the press. Most of this data is already in our management actions in the affected environment sections. A lot of it was pulled from there. So I'm not going to go through all three of these charts for every one of the categories we looked at, which was port group, vessel size, and gear. But I'm going to highlight some of the other ones to show some other problems. This is the landings by vessel length group, and this is one of the weaknesses of only looking at the concentration index. We use four vessel length groups to represent vessel size. These were agreed upon with the Groundfish Committee years ago, back in about 2002, and if you look in all of our management actions since then, we report data based on these vessel length sizes. And once again, much of this data was drawn from those actions. If you look at this, one thing to remember that I didn't point out, so you're hard to remember, is that the minimum value for this concentration index is the number of groups you have. So if all four length groups had 25% of the catch, this number would come out to be 0.25. So as this number gets higher, it means that it's more concentrated. But if you look at this line, I mean, if you do a statistical analysis, yes, this does show a slight decline in the concentration index at the tail end. But you really don't see that this index is changing very much over time. It's relatively minor. That's one of the weaknesses of the index approach, because if two groups switch their share, the index looks the same. And so, for example, this is something that will probably be surprising to some of you, is that with respect to groundfish landings, in recent years, the share of groundfish landings landed by vessels between 30 to 50 feet in length has increased. The share of groundfish landings by vessels 50 to 75% feet in length has decreased. And 75 feet and over has kind of fluctuated around their median level. So this, looking at graphs like this, can highlight changes that you don't see if you just look at the concentration index. When we look at gear, this highlights one of the problems with our data and why you have to be a little bit careful with the data. For starters, back in this period in the 80s, there was a different reporting system, and there has been, I think, some evidence that small ports and small vessels were underrepresented in the weigh-out system back in those years. So when you look at the data back here, you see a whole lot of landings, and if you were actually to look, a lot of this is big trawl boats in the major ports, because it was. And then when we did the other reporting system in Amendment 5, you can see that the concentration index seems to have dropped. Then it starts to increase again, and all of a sudden you see it plummet here in 2004, 2005. We think that if when you look at the charts, you'll see that the unknown gear group increases right here. And we think that in large measure this apparent decline isn't really that landings are getting more diverse. It's that with the advent of electronic dealer reporting, there was a spell where we were getting less information on gear on the trips. And so that shows up in this graph. Now, forget where I'm at. One of the last things we did was we wanted to look at area fished, because one of the things the council was interested in was an inshore-offshore fishery. So we speculated on a couple things. One is it's difficult for us to create a time series of that because we didn't have VMS forever. So what we used is reported area fished as reported on the VTR, and we know there are errors in there because some vessels that fish in multiple areas on a trip don't report all the areas they fish in, even though that's a VTR requirement. And what we did is we looked at where they reported catching ground fish on the VTR and created a time series, and we split it up and we identified the number of permits that fished in both what we called inshore and offshore areas, and there's a chart on how we define that in the paper, those who fished only inshore and those who fished offshore. And what you see is that the percentage of boats fishing only offshore has increased gradually. The percentage of boats fishing both areas has, kind of flat after a drop in here. And then I'm not quite sure what you say about inshore because it was rising, then it declined, then it was rising again. Now, we speculated on the PDT that this is probably related, at least in part, to vessel size. So we did this same type of analysis with vessel size. We did it by vessel size group. I'm not going to show you all the charts here. They're in the paper. Not surprisingly, when you do it by vessel size, you find that the boats 30 feet and under fish almost exclusively in the inshore areas. 30 to 50 feet starts to spread a little bit. There's a few that fish only offshore, but almost all of them fish either inshore or offshore. When you get to the 50 to less than 75 feet, you start to see some changes over time. You see that the number of them that fished, the percentage of them, I should be more accurate here, that fished in both areas has been declining since about 02, and the percentage of those that fished only inshore has been increasing since around the same time period. There's also been a slight increase in the number that have fished only offshore. When you look at the 75 and over, you see that the percentage of those that fished both areas has declined, percentage that fished inshore only has declined, and the percentage that reported fishing offshore has increased. Now, once again, this is reported area fished, so it may not represent precisely where all the activity is. What this suggests to us, at least in part, is that if you're interested in an inshore-offshore fishery, if you keep a mix of vessel sizes, you can get at that issue and probably get at that issue in large measure rather than trying to construct other tools to create an inshore-offshore fishery. So one of the issues that we haven't looked at yet, because we're still trying to collect the data on it, is the issue of vessel ownership or permit ownership. That data is not readily available. We have some of it assembled. We hope to assemble more over the next month, so that's not in here. Clearly, we do have some data that we can use to try and identify and summarize the changes that the council may be interested in. After Ann is done, we're interested in some feedback if there are some more things you would like to see that we can try and take a look at as we move forward with this.
Okay, so once we've laid out the baselines and the definitions of diversity, the next section was considerations for accumulation limits. In general, there's two reasons that accumulation limits are used in fisheries. One is to prevent market control, and the other is to achieve management goals. Market power, or at least the power to influence the price of the product, is not a concern in New England due to the availability of product substitutes. The Science Center is doing or has done a study on that that's going to be included as an appendix to this paper in a later draft, but it's not quite ready yet to be attached to the paper and go out. But that is the conclusion of that paper, is that there is no ability to influence price by market power in New England. There's three types of accumulation limits that have been used in other fisheries. Well, really two. There's ownership limits, usage limits, and sector limits haven't been used, but that's something that we considered in the paper that could be used. And I'll describe all those next. I just want to reiterate that ownership issues can be different from diversity issues. Diversity can include who's participating in a fishery and the infrastructure of the fishery, and the makeup of vessels in a fishery, and all sorts of things. And whereas ownership is really a question of who owns the permits in the fishery. And they're very different questions and may have very different outcomes, or the council may have different desires to handle those two differently. different caps, the three different types of caps there are appropriate for achieving different management goals. So clear definition of the goals is important in deciding what type of caps are appropriate. And other tools to consider that can be used in conjunction with accumulation limits to meet management goals are things like community set-asides, owner on board requirements, and there are other ones described in the paper that can be used in place of or in addition to the accumulation limits. Of the three types of accumulation limits, the first, vessel usage limits, that's really a question of how much fish one boat is able to catch, aimed at keeping a minimum number of vessels in the fleet and maintaining some of the character of the fleet as it is today. Those are the types of goals that could be achieved with those. And questions of fleet consolidation and the direction of desired consolidation, if at all, would need to be addressed if vessel usage limits were considered. The next type of accumulation limit is control limits, and that determines how much quota or what share of a fishery one entity is able to own or possess. It's meant to ensure that no person captures an unreasonable share of the public resource, and they can be used as a buffer against the anti-competitive effect of concentrated ownership. The question there is what is an unreasonable or unfair share of public resource? That would be something that would have to be defined. Control limits have issues with unknown ownership. Like Tom just said, we're compiling ownership info for New England now. There is a question of how accurate that information is and how, if we were to use a control limit, how into the future we could have that ownership information and know that it's accurate. And finally, a sector limit could be applied. There's a lot of ways that could be done. It could either cap the amount of ACE that one sector can control, or it could cap catch within a sector, including leases, or it could exclude leased ACE. There could be usage caps within a sector. And the problem is that they would need additional rules addressing the governance and membership of sectors in order for any sector limit to be useful. Because as it is, a sector could, if you just put a cap on a sector, it could just splinter into two sectors that were effectively the same as one sector. And so a lot of the goals of sectors as they were implemented to have sort of their own management and have the ability to do what they wish to meet business goals, some of those things would have to be revisited if there was going to be an effective type of sector limit implemented. And sector limits in and of themselves wouldn't necessarily force geographic or fleet diversity unless additional limitations were placed on the limits. Other considerations for accumulation limits, there are a few listed in the paper. One is whether accumulation limits could be species specific or whether they'd be aggregate in a multi-species fishery like groundfish. There's a lot of considerations for each there in the paper. I'm not sure we need to go in all of them in detail. Another consideration for accumulation limits is a control date. At the April Council meeting, there was a motion to provide a control date for accumulation limits. That motion failed, so the council, I suppose, has already spoken that they don't want control dates, but that is something that's in the paper as a tool that other fisheries have used in establishing accumulation limits. And finally, the last consideration that we came up with was the interaction of accumulation limits with permit banks. It would depend on the definition of permit banks and how that definition develops and how permit banks are implemented, but it shouldn't be ignored anyway if accumulation caps are being considered. This, I know you probably can't read this, but it's a summary table that's in the paper that just shows how, depending on what the management objectives are, that different types of limits are effective. And just some, it's not supposed to be exhaustive, but just an example of different types of goals and how different types of limits would be most effective in meeting those goals. Finally, there's a pretty brief summary of accumulation limits in other fisheries. It was very difficult to gather data about accumulation limits in other fisheries because the development and objectives of the accumulation limits in general weren't clearly defined. We did find that most catchier fisheries do have individual limits. Some have vessel limits and other types of limits. There's a wide range of the cap themselves, ranging from none to a 1% cap to a 49% cap on individual ownership, depending on the fishery. And other tools were used in a lot of fisheries, or most fisheries, in conjunction with accumulation caps to limit the control of quota, such as community development quotas and those different types of programs. So in conclusion, we don't have huge conclusions since this was only the draft paper of the first two-thirds, but Magnuson-Stevens Act requires caps for laps, so they could be considered here. Fleet size and attribute goals should be considered when choosing the type of cap because they have very different effects. Efficiency should be balanced with the appropriate amount of consolidation. That's a policy question for the council. And that the different types of caps affect the outcomes. The questions we have for consideration are, first of all, is any additional baseline information needed? And what types of analysis can be performed to inform the council's consideration of accumulation limits if the council adopts the committee's recommendation to develop accumulation limits for this fishery?
Thank you very much. Council members, questions or comments for Tom or Annie? Jim Adler?
Yeah, in looking into accumulation limits, wouldn't you have to try to figure out, some kind of profitability? Because if you set your accumulation limits or your limits per vessel or your vessel usage at a level that's below profitability, then what have you done? You've hurt an industry. So I think it's just my thinking here. So you got to try to figure out that in addition to this information. And is that possible? And then in New England, we have to look at, we have evidence that the fleet's extremely old. It's got to be replaced, and it's going to cost money to do that. And so I'm more concerned that we're going to go too far the other way than we are trying to let the fleet consolidate to some number. I don't know what it is, and I don't know where the cap should be, but I do know we need to figure out some of the profitability ideas, and if we're going to be hit with cost in the future, we have to figure that in. And so it's just another study, but I wouldn't know how to do it, so I'm asking Tom or Ann if there's a way to look at that in addition to some of this other information as we move down this road.
One of the things we've done in the past in some of our management actions is we've tried to take into account the profitability of trips. And what you're talking, I think, is an extension of that. We've got some data on the variable costs of a trip and can figure out, how much the vessel is making above the variable trip cost. I think ultimately you're right. I think the minimum level, I don't know if it's the minimum or the maximum level, but the smallest amount you want to give a boat may be the amount that's going to allow him to be profitable. Now, I don't know what is a reasonable profit. And then when you start talking about the cost to invest for replacing a vessel, where we start to fall apart is, I think, in our data is on the fixed cost data. And I'm not sure that a vessel replacement is a fixed cost, but I think under the economist terms, but that's the type of thing that we have a hard time estimating. I imagine that we could come up with some sort of idea, but it would probably be a ballpark, and it would have to be probably by vessel length and vessel gear, for example. We know that the profitability of gillnetters and longliners and trawlers of the same size on a trip is different, and so that would affect all that. I mean, that's probably something if you're going to pursue an ownership cap of some kind, that's probably something that we do need to look at.
Dr. Weinberg?
Thank you. The Mid-Atlantic Council and the Center are there's a review that's being done of the clam fishery related to defining excessive shares in the surf clam and ocean quahog fishery. So I just wanted to say that this council should keep tabs on what they're doing, and probably a report will come out of that review within the next 6 months or so. So I know they felt that their staff wasn't skilled in or trained in the estimate of excessive shares, and they had to hire experts from the outside in order to get the expertise to study this. So anyway, just wanted to let people know this is going on with the Mid-Atlantic Council.
Dave Gaffel.
Yeah, to Jimmy's point on profitability, I think it's an interesting concept, but I think it's also variable not only among boats of the same size, but boats within a port. You know, I use my own port as an example. They're all basically 40-foot boats, give or take a few feet. And, you know, some guys can get by on $100,000 gross stock, and some need $500,000 gross stock, depending on how heavily they capitalize themselves. So I don't think you're going to be able to create a uniform standard of profitability. One of the things they've looked at in Iceland recently is this issue of ownership shares and excessive ownership shares, and they are ordering divestiture of some of these very large, heavily capitalized firms because the government's feeling is that they've wasted their capital, that they didn't, you know, they used it poorly. They didn't reinvest in their own boats and whatnot. They invested in Iceland's banks or some other unit outside of fishing that failed. And so they're ordering divestiture of these corporations of their fishing quota to smaller vessels in outlying villages because they've decided that employment in Iceland is more important than a handful of people making a lot of money. So I think there's a, you know, we can apply almost an infinite set of parameters and come up with an infinite set of solutions. And probably at some point, the council will need to have a debate on exactly, you know, what it sees is a goal. It gets back to the same thing that we keep batting about. What do we want the fishery to look like in the future? And the two extremes are, you know, thousands of small boats or one giant boat. And chances are we want to be somewhere in the middle with a mix. So personally, I think we should do that first and then ask our staff to go out and look at where we are relative to where we want to be and see what we have to do to adjust it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am curious about on page 14, under conclusions, next step, the third bullet, it says balance efficiency with appropriate amount of consolidation. I can't get my head wrapped around that at all. How you would balance efficiency with an appropriate, what's an appropriate amount of consolidation? I have no idea what any of that means. And I agree with Jim, both Jim and Dave Gaethel, excellent points. And what Dave's talking about is a preconceived vision of what the fleet should look like. And I guess we have to be there somehow, but I want to be very leery of engineering somebody's vision of some snapshot in time of what New England looked like and we want it to look like again. Is that where we're going? Because I that's not going to work. And in no place here do I see any mention of changing in markets and how we factor that in. And I wouldn't know how to do it. I just think that it's got to be part of this. So I agree with Jimmy about the profitability thing, but at the same time we do have to have some sort of limits to protect the fairness of the market, so we don't have one giant boat that controls the markets. That's what we have to avoid. But as far as this third bullet, I don't understand what it means.
Right, you had a motion on this, right? Why don't we put a motion up?
Yeah,
it was already up.
It's already up.
Yeah. Okay. Just so we can focus things along. I think we could go all night talking about this, but there is a recommended action from the committee to the council. I'd like to focus our conversation there if we can. Jimmy?
Yeah, my comment, I'm sorry I wasn't at the committee meeting, but my comment is that the committee recommends based on the report. Now, I've read the report and I heard the report. If you look at the report, it doesn't say we have an issue. So, a consolidation issue. It seems like everything's pretty evenly, you know, it has stayed pretty relatively constant, other than the small boats have increased their catch. So, I just wonder why that. And I wasn't there, so I'm asking, why is that part of it, based on the report? Based on the report, what does that lead you to believe? And what is it? I don't know if I'm being clear, but based on the report, where I read that, there's something in the report that is telling you we need to do this. I just want to know what that is.
Dave?
Yeah, I had written that down. That was going to be my first question, exactly what Jim asked. I would recommend the establishment of individual accumulation caps with or without the report. I don't think the report is germane. I don't have a strong feeling about it. I'm not going to make a motion to get it out of there, but I agree. I think we need accumulation caps with or without the report.
Sally?
Thanks. The reference to the report is to the table that's at the end. It's on page 35 and 36. And it was really pretty simple that if you look at all the columns and compare them and you look at individual accumulation caps, you see that there's one fishery that does not have accumulation caps, and that is surf clam ocean quahog. That's where the reference came that was put into this motion, that in looking at these example fisheries that were presented at the back of the paper that and put together, that was one clear example of something that is missing in a fishery that a lot of people in this region are familiar with and know the problems in terms of consolidation and that's lacking in the groundfish plan. So this motion was offered.
Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. However we ultimately vote on this, if it gets voted up, seems to me that this is an item that goes to the executive committee. We've got priorities coming up. It can get into the list, and we can you know, figure out what we think is best to deal with.
Paul Hart.
Tom and Ann, that was a great report. Is there any way you could look at over time, like in the scallop fleet, we talk about how many multiple boat owners there are when we were talking about, you know, consolidation. Is there any way you could track over time multiple boat owners to see where they were and where they are today? And then that all changes when you get to sectors. But, you know, I was just interested over time. I know the permits changed probably when people started buying permits. But has the single owner operator type fishery changed over time?
The data on ownership over time is kind of weak. What we're trying to do right now is basically a snapshot of where ownership is now, and we're not even really defining now as of a specific date. Now is as of the time we can get all the data together, so it's going to be a little blurry. You know, one of the things that we could do perhaps that would be very simplistic is to look at the names on the permit owners and see how many, you know, names match up. But that doesn't work well with corporate entities. And the center does have a project that they're working on with the region to try and collect ownership info for the multi-species fishery. We're not sure if that's going to be finished in time to help us on this or not. And I'm not sure if that's really going to be much of a time series or if it's going to be more of a snapshot.
Anything further on the motion from the board? Anyone in the audience? Brett?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Brett Tolley with Northwest
Atlantic Marine Alliance. Today I'm speaking on behalf of NAMA. I'm also speaking on behalf of my fishing family. I'm from a four-generation fishing family. My brother, my father, my uncles, and my cousins are all active commercial fishermen. I want to say thank you to the council staff for putting together the white paper. I think it is really valuable looking at the baselines for fleet diversity. And looking at the graphs, it does give a sense, as Mr. Jim Odlin had said, it looks relatively diverse in terms of geographical distribution, gear types, and the rest. But I think the issue is that right now in New England, we're in a new management system, and a lot is changing right now, especially in terms of fleet diversity. So today I want to talk about the problem of consolidation. I want to talk about a vision moving forward, and I want to talk about the urgency to take action now. The problem is consolidation. I've noticed, I think, over the past couple committee and council meetings, it's been a challenge to understand and identify exactly what the problem is. Consolidation and catch share programs without any safeguards put in place throughout the United States has resulted in monolithic, industrial-scale, non-owner-operator fleets. A great example, as Sally McGee just pointed out, is the Mid-Atlantic surf clam and ocean quahog fishery, which put no safeguards, no accumulation limits. And right now, the ground fishery in New England would be in that same category. Oftentimes, there's been other tools used to address the problems of consolidation and excessive consolidation. However, it's always been retrospective. Right now is an opportunity for the council to be proactive and set safeguards in place now before the damage is too late. We're already seeing signs of excessive consolidation right now. The cost of leasing and permits is skyrocketing, and at the same time is migrating from the small and mid-scale to the larger and more industrial scale. And now you don't have to take my word for it. I've been working with fishermen and speaking with ground fishermen throughout New England, and it's unfortunate that a lot of small, mid-scale family fishermen, owner-operators, are not here today. For that reason, at NAMA, we've been trying to connect the fishermen who are affected by consolidation, who care about consolidation and want their voices heard, and make a connection or bridge that gap so that their voices can be heard by the council. And one of the strategies that we use for that is to create video testimonies. I want to thank the council staff for allowing us to include a link of video testimonies with the council's materials. And I wanted to point out that we've left a video on the display table where you can listen to the voices of fishermen throughout New England who are being affected and do care about consolidation. I want to just take a minute and give you a sense of what some of the fishermen, the voices out in the hallway, are saying. If you stick with the system over time, you're going to see a lot of the gillnetters and hook boats get wiped out, and there will be no diversity. In order to keep the diversity, there needs to be some incentives. Two of my friends have already sold out, and I tried to get in on the purchase of both boats, but there's so much competition and money out there, the price went from something that was a stretch for me to double that. It's hard for someone like myself to buy more allocation just to stay in it. I don't agree with the consolidation. They say that you can lease, but I can't lease. All the bigger boats and stronger boats are buying up all the allocation. And when I go in to bid on it, it's so high already that I can't match it. I fear that consolidation will change the diversity of the fleet. Instead of having a mix of handliners, gillnetters, draggers, large and small, we're going to see less fishing boats, and the most of the quota migrate to only a few fishing companies, and those fishing companies will own much larger boats. Myself, my fish buyers, and my community won't be able to compete in this kind of market. The way things are going, there aren't going to be any new entrants into the fishery, and that's sad. My crew member is 25 and loves fishing, but there's no way he can get into it now and actually own part of it unless he wins the lottery or something. I think you really need to think about what you want the future of the industry to look like. So that's the problem of consolidation, and that's what it's looking like right now. I think the way to move forward is to have a longer-term vision. And I wanted to point out that some of the language for a longer-term vision already exists within the goals and objectives of Amendment 16. It seems like there's, you know, talk about fleet diversity and whether or not we want to consider fleet diversity, but fleet diversity is actually a goal and objective. I want to just read quickly. The Amendment 16, goal number 2, is explicit. There's language that says achieve goals to encourage diversity within the fleet. Objective number 7 says to maintain a diverse groundfish fishery, including different gear types, vessel sizes, geographical locations, and levels of participation. Goal number 4 says to minimize adverse impacts of fishing communities and shoreside infrastructure. So I want to ask the council members, what are the safeguards or mechanisms that are set in place to ensure that those goals and objectives will be achieved? I can't think of any. And I did want to, you know, point out that there's been a lot of time spent on the discussion around permit banks, which I think is extremely valuable. I think the states have recognized, and I appreciated Mr. Paul Howard asking what are the goals and objectives, and Mr. Terry Stockwell had answered there are objectives to address consolidation of the fleet and ensure that there are access for small-scale fishermen and small communities. A lot of time has been spent on addressing that problem, and the states are on top of it, trying to create permit banks. But I think that the council at the same time needs to address the problem and identify ways that you can move forward to achieve those goals and objectives that are under Amendment 16. I also want to mention the Fleet Visioning Project that has similar language. Us at NAMA, we presented to the Interspecies Committee in April the Fleet Visioning Project. I've also mentioned it at past council meetings. And it represents the most authentic voice of the New England community. Took 2 years, over 250 stakeholders from throughout New England came together, identified a common vision. The outcome boiled down to one sentence is a diverse fishery, economically viable, environmentally sustainable, that is managed through a participatory governance structure. So again, there's that language of diversity. And Amendment 16, as it stands, will completely undermine that vision, as well as undermine the goals and objectives of Amendment 16, and ultimately undermine many of the conservation efforts that we're all working hard towards. There is a connection between fleet diversity and conservation efforts. There's a connection between who fishes and sustainability. And I want to point out to the council members that we submitted a letter that was written during the January of this year that was signed on by scientists throughout New England that was pointing out this connection between fleet diversity and conservation efforts. And to give a sense of basically what the letter was saying is that there is evidence that shows that in order to recover fish stocks and to recover a healthy ecosystem, we need a diverse fishing fleet that matches the diverse ecosystem. So I encourage council members to read over that letter as well. So who fishes matters. Fleet diversity matters to communities, to the ecosystem, and it also matters to our food system. I think fish, you know, are harvested to feed our communities and our families. So I think it's reasonable to understand what consolidation on the land has done to our food system. If we think back 30 years, during the farm crisis, policies went in the same direction of consolidation without any safeguards put in place. And now, 30 years later, we can learn about what that meant. It's done damage to our communities. It completely displaced the small family farmer. It has done damage to our on-land ecology, adding chemicals and dangerous pesticides. And it's resulted in really low-quality food that now we're seeing the onset of diabetes, obesity, and a lot of other food-related diseases that are all a result of the industrial-scale food system. So I wanted to also point out, I hope that kind of addresses what the problem is and what the consequences are. And at NAMA, we've worked on creating a discussion paper to look at some other catch-share programs around the United States to offer possible solutions to what could work here in New England. I think before getting into this, you know, solutions, it's important that we really recognize and acknowledge the problem. I think accumulation limits are absolutely a solution. I think it's important that other safeguards be put in place at the same time as accumulation limits. I just want to also read just very quickly what the fishermen are saying out there in the hallway. I'm in favor of consolidation caps. I'm in favor of owner-operator status. I'm in favor of consolidation limits. I believe that a few big guys is not a good idea. A lot of boats can fish a little bit is better than a couple boats fishing the whole quota. I'm in favor of consolidation caps, and I want my voice heard. And I want to say very quickly that I know that there's been talk of a LAP, and this is not a LAP fishery. And so why are we offering accumulation limits if we're not in a LAP? If we want to go towards an ITQ, then we can talk about accumulation limits. But I want to point out that it's irrelevant. If this is not a LAP, we have specific goals and objectives within Amendment 16 that are very clear that the goal is to achieve fleet diversity, and there's even language that describes what fleet diversity is. I think this is accumulation limits are absolutely a tool to achieve those goals and objectives, and that's it. So I just want to conclude by saying that the council has an opportunity now to be proactive on this issue. I know with the Mid-Atlantic Surf Clam Ocean Quahog fishery, it was started back in 1990. It's taken 20 years for that fishery to recognize the need now to set accumulation limits. And if I know, I was just out on the boat in Long Island 2 weeks ago with a fisherman that was involved in that fishery, and basically has said that it's really a monopoly at this point, and accumulation limits may do some positive things, but ultimately the damage has been done. Or the example of the Iceland fishery, now they're asking fishermen to, or corporations to divest their quota. We have an opportunity now not to get that far down the line. We can set accumulation limits as well as other tools to ensure that we have a diverse fishery. We ask you to acknowledge that there's a serious problem and to commit to finding effective solutions and to take action in the context of Framework 45. Look forward to working with the council and the staff on this issue. Thank you very much.
Eddie?
Ed Barrett, commercial fisherman. I think, you know, diversity, accumulation limits, these things are all important things when we're considering the small boat fleet. But I urge the council to be cautious in its approach, because I think some of these things that we might try to do will actually hurt people right now trying to deal with the program, the catch share allocation cards that they've been dealt. For instance, if I'm going to a bank right now, I have to go and tell them, well, yeah, I need a couple $100,000 to buy a permit that has a quota, sort of a quota, but it's not really a quota. I'm afraid of baselines and whatever else gets thought up being added to that ambiguity that makes bankers in this credit market glass over and say, see you later. So, you know, small boats are having a tough time with this. But we really need to be sure that whatever we do, there's not a backlash to it. And on another, you know, there are people who do want to sell out. And I think that to be fair to them, they should be able to get as much money for their permits right now. Because, and I think we're going, I think there are a lot of market conditions that are that could possibly, you know, especially if we're talking limitations that would limit the return for some of these people. So I would be very cautious about what we're talking about, seeing as how we don't have a LAP and we don't have an ITQ. And until we sort all these issues out, I don't think the council should make any take any action. Thank you.
Thank you for this opportunity to speak. My name is Hannah Mellian, and I work at Farm Fresh Rhode Island. Farm Fresh is a nonprofit that works to regrow the local food system in Rhode Island. The local food movement has been part of an incredible resurgence in agriculture over these past few years, and I believe that the lessons learned can provide guidance for the local fishing communities and marine policymakers. I will share what we have seen working with local farmers in Rhode Island to provide a context for your work here today. At Farm Fresh, we've looked closely at what makes a food system sustainable, one that addresses the needs of producers, eaters, and the environment. We envision a food system that provides fresh and healthy food for eaters, maintains economically viable businesses for producers, and protects small family farms, one that preserves farmland and agricultural knowledge so that we can continue to produce good food for future generations. The growth of industrial consolidated agriculture began in the 1930s with subsidized commodity crops on 1,000-acre farms. These policies quickly wiped out the small family farms across New England. We lost agricultural land, knowledge, farmers, and the relationships and networks that bring food from local farms to tables. As our food supply began to come from larger producers located farther and farther away, we lost touch with the importance of the people behind our food. We stopped paying attention to how it was grown and where it was coming from. After decades of letting farms and agricultural infrastructure disappear, we're beginning to see a shift in the way our food is being produced. People, when asked, want to buy local food. They want their food dollars to benefit their community and the places that they live. So through coordinated campaigns to re-educate people about where their food comes from, consumers have begun to demand local food for their homes and at their groceries, restaurants, and more. It's creating new markets and sources of income for local farmers, which means existing farms are growing and new farms are starting and surviving. In fact, the 2007 Census of Agriculture shows that there's been a 42% increase in the number of farms since 2002. We've seen tremendous opportunity for small-scale, family-run operations to thrive through direct marketing opportunities. Direct marketing allows farmers to set fair prices for their products, prices that allow them to continue farming. The number of farmers markets has doubled in the past 5 years. There are now 45 farmers markets across the state of Rhode Island, of which Farm Fresh runs 7 in the summer and 2 in the winter that reach thousands of people every week. There are 20 community-supported agriculture programs, or CSAs, serving about 1,500 families who pay in advance for subscription of local vegetables and over 50 farm stands. There are fabulous examples in our region, such as the Port Clyde Fresh Catch, of successful community-supported fisheries programs, modeled after community-supported agriculture programs, in which cooperatives of small fishermen offer weekly pickups of fresh fish to local customers. NAMA has been working to set up similar programs in Rhode Island, and we at Farm Fresh have been working with a co-op in Bristol to sell at our farmers markets and area restaurants. The threat of consolidation will undermine these efforts and the progress already made to link small fishermen to local food resources and prevent these new initiatives from really making a difference in the lives of these fishermen. In addition to the important supply of food that local marine resources provide, the protection of small-scale fisheries is a matter of pride for Rhode Island. We are the ocean state, and our coastal communities are an integral part of our state and our region's heritage and its current way of life. Our waterfronts have provided sources of work, income, and sustenance for its residents for hundreds of years. It is our responsibility to protect and nurture these invaluable resources for future generations. The growth we have seen in agriculture in these economic times is extraordinary and speaks to the potential opportunities for local fishing communities to prosper as well. Local food production is economic development. Every family farm, every fishing family is a small business. and we know that supporting small businesses keeps money circulating in our own communities, which benefits all of us. The local foods movement has built the infrastructure that will allow small fishermen to grow their business. There are new and exciting marketing strategies already in practice, and we have great plans for the future for small fisheries in Rhode Island. Our farmers' markets are ready, and our customers who want to know their farmer want to know who their fishermen are, too. Now we just need to make sure that we protect the most important piece, small-scale producers whose operations protect natural resources and keep marine knowledge and money in our communities. Find the solution that protects the heritage of our region, our food supply, and the livelihoods of hundreds of our friends and family. Take the hard lessons learned by our region's small farmers and choose to protect our food producers and build smart systems today. Help us create a food system that nurtures the people who harvest our food and nourishes all of us who eat. Thank you very much.
Okay. I'm going to call this meeting at 6 o'clock because we've run tremendously long for 2 days. This is our third day, so I'll take one or two more comments on this, come back to the motion, and then we're going to button her up. The staff still has to clean this room up, and this isn't a final action item. We have a motion on the board, so to the motion on the board. Aaron, to the motion on the board.
Aaron Doherty, Penobscot East Resource Center. So I'll keep this brief since we have 10 minutes before 6 o'clock. I just want to let you know I support the comments that you've heard earlier from Brett Tolley from NAMA. I think this boils down to one issue, that we've put in place a system right now that will force small operators out of business without changes. And this is the opportunity to make some of those changes. I appreciate the presentation that was made by Annie and Tom. I think that one thing that we really need to pay attention to right now is not only the changes that have happened under the Days at Sea system, but also the changes that we're seeing now, perhaps more importantly, under the transition to a catch share system. This year in Maine, we've seen a 49% decline outside of Portland in landings. In New Hampshire, we've seen a 43% decline. That's year-to-date landings between those two times. Now, that may change at the end of the year. But if we stay on track for that, we've already seen consolidation and dramatic changes in 1 year. So I think we need to be really cognizant of that vision, that perception in mind of what we want this fishery to look like. I think we've got to recognize also people can sell out, banks can lend, and we can have consolidation. But we can do this in a way that has forethought, that has vision about what we want this fleet to look like in the long term. I think ultimately we want to make sure that that we don't let the groundfish fishery eclipse the surf clam ocean quahog fishery in terms of the poster child of what consolidation can turn a fishery into. We've heard that example tossed around a number of times, and I think this is our opportunity now to take a stand and to set this fishery apart in terms of catch share fisheries that can achieve a vision that we'd like. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Aaron. Vito?
Is just a quick question. The next appropriate action, you'd be talking about an amendment, I assume, as opposed to a framework that you would handle something like this? That could be a framework?
Gene?
It would be an amendment. Okay. Good. And I just wanted to point out that as far as consolidation, just to report what's going on, the sector system, as much as folks feel we should have gone right to an ITQ, is actually preventing a lot of consolidation from happening. There's all of the sectors have right of first refusal. We're not seeing in our sectors this consolidation. In fact, there was more consolidation in Framework 42 under the Day at Sea system than I've seen at all under the sector system. So we may be having a fear of something that's not actually occurring yet. And I think that these protections, so I would be very careful. That's why I think the amendment's the right place for it. Before we remove the protection of sectors and go to a different system, because I really feared the sectors, because it was an ITQ with no protections built in. But it's actually, as I look at it, the sectors are providing protection for the communities to figure out how, with the right of first refusal, to keep, to keep people in business. So although many people are short of quota, there were people short of days, And another thing I'd like to point out, I'm a director of a permit bank in Gloucester, and I'll come right out and say when we talk about consolidation, permit banks are consolidators. That's what they do. We don't have to do a consolidation report because we've consolidated to one. That's what they are. So if we're looking for fleet diversity and we're starting more permit banks and we're having unlimited funding, I think we have to be, it should be part of a very deliberate process of what we want the fishery to look like, because that's exactly what they do. We've spent $7 million and bought 40-odd permits, I'll tell you, right up front, and now it's one. And Framework 42 did that. We went 50% cut in days at sea at 2-to-1, and 100 guys were insolvent. We knew we had to buy 40 permits to keep 50 guys fishing. And luckily we kept 70 fishing because we bought a few permits outside the community. So permit banks should be rescuing something. And for right now, we don't have consolidation occurring at the rate that people are fearing it's occurring, and it's because of the sector veils. So I just wanted to let you know that that's a good report at this point.
Okay, back to the council. Billy?
Bill Chaprales, former hook fisherman, Cape Cod. As far as profitability is concerned, I'm out of business, along with dozens of other hook fishermen that had a vision for the future. And I think that's what this council really has to focus on, is a vision of the future, because there's a lot of good fishermen that are out of business, and that's because there are no fish to catch. Small boat fishermen, inshore, can't make a living anymore ground fishing with hooks, I'm talking about. And I think you've got to kind of look at gear types and area management and gear types, because we couldn't compete with other boats. And I'm not going to get into, you know, down on a gear type or anything else, but we just couldn't compete with them. That's why we're out of business. Hooks are the lowest impacted gear type out there, and the first ones to go was us. And it's just a shame that we can't have young people coming back into this fishery. I went into the lobster fishery to stay in business. I get young guys coming down and saying to me, geez, how do I get into the fishery? What can I do? I can't give them any answers. My son fishes with me now, and I wish he wasn't fishing with me. And I hear the same with a lot of good guys that are out of the fishery, are still trying to struggle and stay in. I know guys from Gloucester, hard fishermen all their lives. They got to go out on a limb and buy quota now. They don't know what to do. They don't even like to go fishing anymore. They call me up and tell me, what do you think? I says, there's got to be a change here. And that's the change it has to be. Is this council has to look for a vision into the future to save this industry so we can bring young people back in here with good ideas, just like what you heard tonight. That's what we need, and I hope you focus on that. Thank you.
Okay, back to the council. Motion on the board. Anything further? Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Unanimous. Motion passes. Anything else? Anything else under groundfish? Any other business a council member wishes to bring forward? 6 o'clock. Time to go home. Good job.